Today at Reader's Corner, we speak with Timothy Snyder, acclaimed historian and author of the new book, On Freedom. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today has been called the leading interpreter of our dark times. As a historian, he has provided startling reinterpretations of political collapse and mass killings. His previous book, On Tyranny, became an instant classic, inspiring people around the globe to recognize and resist authoritarianism. In his latest book, On Freedom, Timothy Snyder argues we have lost sight of what the great American commitment to freedom really means. Drawing on the work of philosophers and political dissidents, conversations with contemporary thinkers, and his own experiences in Ukraine, he identifies the practices and attitudes that will help us design a government in which we and future generations can flourish. Timothy Snyder is a professor of history and global affairs at Yale University and a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. His books, which have been published in over 40 languages, include Bloodlands, Black Earth, On Tyranny, and Road to Unfreedom. He is the host of Timothy Snyder, The Making of Modern Ukraine, a podcast I highly recommend. Timothy Snyder, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Glad to be with you.
That podcast I mentioned, I have so much enjoyed it, and I would certainly urge our listeners to take a listen as well. But for the book On Freedom, which we're here to talk about today, why don't we begin with your take on what freedom is not?
Okay. Well, freedom is not what we think it is the short answer. We've got the right word in our American English, but we've attached it to the wrong concept. What we think freedom is to be against something. We define freedom as freedom from. So freedom from oppression, and usually by oppression, we mean the government. And it's not that that's completely mistaken. It's just that it's only a step towards the truth. The only reason we care about oppression is that we care about people. The only reason why a barrier to your freedom matters is because you're you. It's not the barrier that's the issue. You're the issue. And so even when the barrier is down, even when the government isn't oppressing you directly, the question remains, who are you? What do you want? How are you going to become a free person? And that's what positive freedom means. So positive freedom means not just being against things, but being able to be for things. Mm-hmm.
You call emancipation from the government as the dead end of negative freedom. Your thoughts?
Yeah. So here's why it's a dead end. If you think that freedom, so it's a dead end for you psychologically, but it's really a dead end politically. So it's a dead end psychologically because if I go through life saying the government's the problem, then I never figure out how I'm the problem. The assumption is always that the government is doing these terrible things, but I'm fine. All the stuff I want to do is fine. I must be right. And you're never right. You're never completely right. And if you don't think about who you are, like what you're for, as opposed to just what you're against, which is easy. If you don't think about who you are and what you're for, then you can't be a free person, right? If it's just you against other stuff, then that's predictable. That's boring. There's nothing free about that. In fact, the whole story about you being against the world or you being against the government, it's not even your story. That story was written a long time before you showed up. And so psychologically, it's a dead end, but politically, it's a dead end too, because we can't be free unless we work together to create some preconditions for freedom. You can't get out and go somewhere and make something of yourself without roads, and you can't build the roads. You can't get educated and make decisions about what kind of career you're going to have without schools. And you know, any individual child growing up can't build the schools. And onward and onward and onward, the things that we need to be free, we can only do together with the right kind of government. But if we define freedom as negative, then what we do politically is we say, oh, government's always the problem, like Reagan taught us. We shrink the government down to where it's dysfunctional, and then it can't provide the things that we all need in order to grow up to be free people, and so we end up less free. Mm-hmm. And then we forget that we had any choice, right? And we keep saying freedom, 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 even as we keep shrinking the government, even as we become less free. And then we're in this vicious spiral that we're in right now.
Yeah, in and right now is certainly the way to put it, because it does appear as though that this November election, and I must remind our readers that we're taping this and it's probably going to run after the election, but it almost seems to be a referendum on this subject of how large do you want government? Just ask Elon Musk, who has made some serious promises about reducing the size of government significantly, has he not?
Yeah, and that's a point I should have made responding to your last question. You know, another way that negative freedom ends up being unfreedom is that if you shrink the government, that's not some magical formula for freedom. I mean, you have to be childishly naive to think that.
Yeah.
You know, the people like Musk who say that shrinking the government brings freedom, they don't believe it. They just know that it's a trap for you, right? And the way that it's a trap for you is that if you shrink government, power doesn't disappear. Power just goes elsewhere into some unelected place, like, for example, into the hands of the people who own the social media platforms, into the hands of the billionaires. And the prospect of someone like Elon Musk, who owns a social media platform and is obviously a multi-billionaire, getting hold of the government and shrinking it further is not a prospect of freedom for millions of Americans. It's a prospect of even more power for one person, namely mm-hmm. Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. Because the only instance which can tax the incredibly wealthy and build roads and hospitals and schools for the rest of us is the government. The only instance that can regulate a social media company and make it be more truthful or tax some of its revenues to fund newspapers or whatever it might be is the government. And that's why an Elon Musk is against the government, because only the government can tax him, not that he'd notice, and only the government can regulate his social media platform, which of course would be a good thing. So personally, for somebody like him, shrinking the government can seem to be in his interests. Although I've got to say, he doesn't seem to be a very happy man. I think negative freedom is also kind of a dead end for him. But negative freedom is definitely a dead end for the rest of us, because if we think, oh, shrinking the government equals freedom, then somebody like Musk, whose aspiration is to rule over us all, becomes a hero, which is crazy.
Right. I don't want to blow past Elon Musk too fast here without mentioning Putin's submissive client, as you call him, a hero of negative freedom, none other than Donald Trump, who Musk seems to be serving these days on a foreign policy level, let's say, in our relationships with other nations. How is, I think a good number of our listeners are probably aware of this, but I'd like you to explain it anyway. How, in fact, is Trump Putin's submissive client?
Oh, That's one of these things that, like, maybe Americans don't notice, but it's completely obvious from abroad. I mean, we're very self-absorbed people, right? And especially at times like these, when there's an election going on, we really only think of ourselves. But there are certain things about yourself you can only really notice if you look elsewhere. And this is a basic truth about freedom, by the way. Like, the way when you're self-absorbed and impulsive, you're not really free. You can only be free if you know who you are, and you can only know who you are if you have the ability to listen to other people, because other people notice things about you that you don't notice. That's just a basic point about freedom, which applies to this foreign policy question. If you're looking at it from around the world, it's obvious that Trump is Putin's client. I mean, the man went to Helsinki and explained that he believed Putin more than he believed his American advisors. The man, every time he talks about Putin, praises him. The man called Putin a genius for invading Ukraine, and the man essentially plans to hand over Ukraine to Putin if he wins. There's never been any moment under Trump or associated with Trump where we've exerted pressure on Russia. It's always been Russia's right, the man's a genius. But the submissiveness thing is especially important here, because the United States can be a very strong country, but only on the basis of laws, institutions, norms, which allow us to be free and prosperous people. The thing which Trump reveals is that if we move to a state where the laws don't matter and we have a strong man, we will be much weaker. And Trump is ahead of the game, because Trump is prepared personally to submit to these various gangsters he admires around the world, not just Putin, but Xi. So that's what I mean by submissive client. Trump knows that he owes Putin various debts, and for him, that's the most important thing.
I knew this from listening to your podcast on Ukraine, but in your acknowledgments, you share with the reader the fact that you've had some trips to Ukraine, including your meeting with President Zelensky, and I just think that is so important. an experience when it comes to the arguments you're making here in this book. Share with us the visit to Ukraine, and not just the conversation with Zelensky, which I thought was very interesting, the way he opened it up, but also just meeting average Ukrainians living in the midst of a war.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I'm a historian of Ukraine, among other things, and I've been going to the country for 30 years now, and I speak the language, and I've written books that are mainly about Ukraine, as you know, since the full-scale invasion of February 2022. I've been there four times. I've spent about a month there, and I've been to 9 or 10 of the regions of Ukraine, including being quite close to the front. So, and Ukraine is important. I mean, it's important for the whole world. What happens in Ukraine is going to, whether we realize it or not, it's going to matter a lot to us, because these are people who are, although it sounds like a cliche, it's true in this case, they really are fighting for freedom with a lot of thought about what freedom means. And it matters for the rest of us, because if we let them lose, which is the right way to think about it, they only lose if we let them lose. If we let them lose by not supplying them with the things they need, then Russia dominates Europe. If we let them lose, then the whole idea of borders and law is going to make a lot less sense. If we let them lose, a lot of countries around the world are going to build nuclear weapons, which is dangerous. If we let them lose, we'll be encouraging China to interfere in Taiwan, and that makes a big war in the Pacific much more likely. Or to put this a different way, for the last 2.5 years or so, by resisting Russia, Ukraine has held back an awful lot of bad things. And the irony of that is because they've held back so many bad things, it kind of creates an election season where we can only talk about ourselves as usual, and we don't appreciate what the Ukrainians are doing for us. As far as the book goes, what I did was I took the manuscript there three times. I ended up finishing it on a train ride from Kyiv to the border. And I took it to Ukraine because these were people who were talking about freedom, but also taking a risk for freedom. And in the cases of far, far, far too many, an awful number of people losing their lives or losing their limbs. But it wasn't just that. I mean, I think that demands our attention, right? When you have people who talk about freedom and are actually taking risks. I mean, just to give a scale of the risk, you know, they easily lose more people in a week than we lost in the entirety of the Iraq war, or the entirety of the 20 years we're in Afghanistan. It's a completely different experience of combat than Americans have. And that includes American veterans, that includes American officers, that includes American brass. We haven't been in anything like this. And we should own up to that. We should own up to the scale of that suffering, the scale of that risk, the scale of that loss, and also the scale of what they're doing for us. But anyway, what they were doing for me, and this includes, as you kindly say, you know, my buddies on the front, as well as people in civil society helping them, as well as politicians, as well as everyday folks, what they helped me with was a definition of freedom. And I'll just give you one example, and we can talk about it more if you want. But one thing the Ukrainians say, which is really smart, is they talk about cities not being liberated, but being deoccupied. And the reason they hold back with the word liberated is because of what we talked about at the beginning, the difference between negative freedom and positive freedom. Of course, it's really important to deoccupy a city, because then the Russians are no longer torturing people, then the Russians are no longer kidnapping children, then the Russians are no longer executing local leaders. So, of course, that evil has to be removed. It's important that it is. But the word deoccupation reminds you that even removing the worst of evils isn't the same thing as freedom. You still have to get the water running. You have to clear the rubble. You have to rebuild the buildings. You have to get the bus lines running. You have to get the schools started. And then once you have the conditions of life back in order, once you have some kind of predictability, then you can start talking about freedom. So that's one thing which, you know, the Ukrainian resistance helped me with as I was trying to define negative and positive freedom.
How about your meeting with Zelensky? I love the way he opened it up. I mean, after you told him what you were there for.
Yeah, I've talked to him a couple of times since, but that meeting, the meeting you're referring to, was September 2022, which was the first time that I got to Ukraine. It's an interesting setting. So I'm speaking to a head of state, and I've had occasion to do things like that before. But not in a war and not behind sandbags and, you know, not after a confusing drive to find the president.
Not with a guy wearing a t-shirt.
let me think, that's true. Was he wearing a t-shirt? Yeah, I guess he was. The temper of the conversation was so different in that, you know, I had some things I thought he didn't know about politics, and he already knew those things. And he asked me then, what do I want to talk about? Which is not, I mean, that's not the kind of question that presidents usually ask you. You know, if you have a little bit of time with them, like it's right. To kind of get across your little message, and then you're escorted out of the office. But in this case, he actually asked me what I wanted to talk about. And I did have a thing I wanted to talk about. I mean, the only reason I wanted to talk to him really was to talk about this freedom stuff I was thinking about. And so I said, yes, I want to talk about the philosophy of freedom. And so he spread his arms out in this sort of very welcoming gesture and said, great, let's talk about that. Which was so interesting, right? Because it makes me think, okay, first of all, this is a free person. Because, you know, being a politician is also a way of being captured, because you're captured by your assistants and your agenda. You're captured by the everyday. And he, unlike pretty much any politician at that level, was willing to talk about a subject he hadn't been prepped for, he didn't know was coming, and is a complex, difficult subject. But more than that, he said really interesting things about it. Like he said something, for example, which is really helpful for the overall argument. It was in his answer to my question of why he stayed. So if we can remember back to February 2022, the general expectation by Americans and others was that Ukraine was going to collapse, and of course the president was going to flee. But he didn't flee. He stayed. He made a point of staying. And when I asked him about it, he said something really interesting about freedom too. He talked about how it wasn't really a choice, which seems paradoxical, because you think, okay, if you're a free person, you always have a choice. But I think that's not right. I think what's right is that freedom is about virtues. It's about the good things. It's about the ability to choose among the virtues. And as you choose among them over time, over life, you build up this thing called character. And then if you are a free person, you become a person of character, which means that sometimes you get yourself into a situation, or you find yourself in a situation where there's really only one thing you feel you can do and still be yourself. And that's not because you're unfree. It's precisely because you're free. It's precisely because you've made yourself into a certain kind of person who, when confronted with a certain, in this case, danger, really only sees one way forward, in his case, to stay and to try to lead his people. And I think that's really instructive. I mean, because it's not just the sheer physical courage. It's the consistency. It's that sheer physical courage is consistent with the rest of a life. That if you want to behave that way in those tough situations, you have to be the kind of person who has been making moral choices all along, which I think we sometimes, in our negative freedom paradigm, we forget. We think, well, when the challenge comes, we'll just rise up and face it. I don't think that's right. I think you have to have the, and I think you don't. I mean, I think that's why actually in February 2022, and this is sad for us, but I think that's why in February 2022, we all assumed that he would flee, because we would flee, right? And that's the dangerous thing. Because if you think freedom is just about, I'm just going to do what I feel like, and then when the challenge comes, I'll have the courage, I don't think it works that way. I think freedom has to mean that you show little bits of courage all the time, because you actually care about things, and you make little commitments all the time. You take little risks all the time. And then that way you become something like a free person. And then when there's a big challenge, you have a chance of meeting it. So Zelensky helped me with all that.
Right. Well, you used the editorial "we" in your point about we thought Zelensky would flee, and I'll include myself in that. I mean, the very first thought I had when Russia invaded, based on numerous other historical examples, is the prime minister, the president, gets out of town fast because he knows he'll be executed, or she knows she'll be executed. But you saw it differently from the beginning, did you not?
Well, that's very kind of you to remember. Yeah, I was one of the few people at the time who said Zelensky will stay and they'll fight. I did see it differently at the time, and it had to do with an intuition. I mean, I didn't know him at the time, but it did have I've been following his career, and it had to do with an intuition about what kind of person he was. But it also had to do with some knowledge of Ukraine. I mean, the dominant American way of looking at Ukraine, I think it's fair to say, was that Russia is a very big, important old country, and Ukraine is some little country which maybe we haven't even heard of, and isn't it maybe part of Russia anyway, or somehow historically close to Russia or something like that. I think relatively few Americans had the notion that Ukrainians were a people with their own agency, with their own freedom, with their own choices. They had to prove that to us. And now they have, you know, they've proven it to us in this absolutely incontrovertible way, which deserves respect. But I had the advantage that since I'm a historian of Ukraine and I have lots of Ukrainian friends and I go there all the time, that I knew that in its way it was a highly functional society and that they would have the resources to resist. I didn't know. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to say 3 years in they'll still be fighting, right? But I was sure they were going to resist.
So let's talk about the book, a few chapters of the book, and that's why this is difficult in a very short period of time we have to discuss it. But maybe you could just give us a capsule summary of what you call the five forms of freedom, because that really does lay out this entire manuscript for you.
Okay, thank you. So the way the book is structured, there's an introduction where I try to describe what freedom in fact is, where I make the case that freedom is positive. And then there's a conclusion, which is about politics, where I try to show how much more a government could do if a government were defined in terms of freedom. So we in America, we have this imaginary tension between freedom and government. It's not true. You know, it's not a tension, it's a synthesis. The reason that you need government is because we can't create the conditions of freedom individually. And so a legitimate government is one which is working towards creating the conditions of freedom. Between the beginning and the end, I have five chapters which define five forms of freedom. And the reason I do this is because I am making an argument about what freedom is, but freedom is about people, it's about life. And so whatever the argument is, it has to touch on life as it's actually lived, from birth to death, you know, with maturity and school and getting sick and all of these things which we all experience. It can't be about some abstraction. You know, our normal way we talk about freedom is, here's an abstract hero who's fighting a dragon or something. But that's not what freedom is like. Freedom is about everyday life. And so the forms of freedom start out following a life. The first one is sovereignty. So if freedom means that virtues are real, and we have to choose among them to become free, that means we have to become the kind of people who can recognize virtues, choose among them, and have the power to realize them in life. And that means that we have to pay a lot of attention to babies or young children, because this doesn't happen naturally. And so here at the very beginning of the story, you see how if we want to be free, we have to act collectively, because there's no way that you can raise children on your own. It just doesn't happen. And the more help you have, the better. And the only way you can really have help is to have some organization in the background. The second form of freedom is unpredictability, which for me is in a way the most important. Once you are sovereign, that is, once you have control over yourself and you can make your own judgments and you have your own ideas what is good, then you can be unpredictable. And why is that? It's because the good things, the things we love, our tastes, our values, loyalty, passion, integrity, grace, beauty, these things are not predictable the way that the outside world is predictable. They don't follow the normal laws of geometry or physics. They jumble around in a completely different way. So insofar as we are acting according to values, we're going to act unpredictably. And insofar as we're unpredictable, we're free. The things that try to make us predictable, like social media algorithms or tyrannical politicians, they try to frighten us. They try to back us into corners. They try to make us creatures who can be herded because we have predictable fears or predictable tendencies. The third form of freedom is mobility. So again, like these are stages of life, right? When you grow up at a certain point, you're going to rebel against the very things which allowed you to become a free person. You're going to rebel against your parents, maybe. You're going to want to leave where you grew up, maybe. You want to take on different values, maybe. Maybe you want to move geographically, right? But all of those things, like the social advancement, the new career, the education, even quite literally the road that you would drive on if you left your family's home to go somewhere else, all of that stuff, which is needed for you to become mobile and therefore free, again, requires collective generational political work in order for it to exist. The next two forms, factuality and solidarity, are more general and more retrospective. We have to have factuality all the way through so that we can recognize what we need for freedom and so we can recognize the threats to freedom. We have to, if we have factuality, we have a chance of living in our own story as opposed to someone else's story. And solidarity is the recognition, both philosophically and politically, that freedom for you means freedom for me. Which of course is, you know, it sounds like a truism, but it's hard to get there, and it requires empathy, but it also requires the right kind of politics. Because if we try to design a system where, you know, people like, where some people are free and others aren't, well, of course the people who aren't free are going to be oppressed. But even the people who think themselves to be free are going to be less free than they would be if they had recognized that freedom was for everybody. So that is very quickly the five forms of freedom. Mm-hmm.
And in the last section of your book, you give the reader quite a few examples of what would happen if government gets out of our way. The voting systems of our country at this moment certainly come to mind.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I mean, there are a lot of things which seem like they just kind of happen, but they don't. Or a lot of things which seem like they're an individual right. And they're, of course, an individual right, but the individual right depends upon thinking about other individuals. So voting, as you say, is a really good example of that. You can think really abstractly about voting. You can say, well, there's a ballot box. I went in there and voted, and isn't that beautiful? But of course, how many ballot boxes are there, and how are they located, and what is behind the distribution of those ballot boxes? And why is it that some people don't wait at all and other people have to wait for hours? What is behind all of that? And of course, what's behind all of that ultimately is a notion of freedom, which is about me, 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 as opposed to a notion of freedom, which says we have to recognize everyone as a person, or in this case, everyone as a citizen, and make sure that each of us has the same kind of rights as everyone else. That's where voting should start if we really wanted to be a democracy. There shouldn't be this incredible passive aggressive attention to various administrative or bureaucratic or legalistic difficulties to make it harder for people to vote, which is where we are as a country, right? Like if we wanted to be a land of the free, we would say, everybody votes. We want as many people to vote as possible. You know, if we're going to have ID checks, then we're also going to have IDs, right? Seems reasonable. The whole idea that you wouldn't, okay, fine, check IDs, but if you're going to check IDs, then give everybody an ID. There's no reason to make a circus about this whole thing. So voting's a great example of how, if you're in a privileged position or you're just not thinking about it, you think, okay, well, voting, that's just everybody having an individual right. But in fact, creating a society where everybody can vote and everybody feels comfortable voting is something you can only do with a fair amount of empathy and recognition of your own history and recognition of other people.
Young people tend to be the demographic that has a low voter turnout. Tell us how Canada deals with that, something I didn't realize until I read your book.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is engineered, right? I mean, it's kind of sad, you know, young people think, well, the reason I'm not voting is because I don't feel like it. But when those impulses that you have are often governed by larger circumstances, which you're not thinking about, voting's a process. And like any process, it can be designed better or it can be designed worse. If you want young people to vote, then you have to guide them into that process. So, you know, one thing which used to happen a lot in America, but which happens less often, is that you have civics classes in high school where you're taught about voting, and maybe on election day, you know, you're too young to vote, but maybe you go on a walk and you see people voting, and then you're like one step away from doing it, which is the natural human progression. You lead people up to doing it, and then when the time comes, they do it themselves. That's what the Canadians do. They have a youth voter register where they prepare people for the idea that they're going to vote. They make it seem logistically and psychologically easy and natural. And therefore, they get a much higher voter turnout. I mean, the Canadians in general, there's a reason why America turns off Canada, you know, because they do certain things better than us and we don't like it. But the voter turnout in Canada in general is higher than here. And voter registration there is north of 90%. And that just seems normal if you come to think of it. I mean, everybody should be registered. Like there shouldn't be bureaucratic hangups about this. There shouldn't be difficulties about this. This should be the kind of thing where we should be ashamed if people aren't registered, and we should be ashamed if people aren't voting. We should be trying to make everything as easy as possible for everyone so that the numbers are really high. And then we should celebrate that.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. There's been some clicking in the midst of your last answer, and I just wanted to make sure that we were okay. James, are we all right? Okay to go on?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. All right. Maybe it's at my end. I don't know. But anyway, okay. You mentioned high school and civics classes. I don't want to let universities off the hook either when it comes to this business of teaching American government. When I taught my first class at a community college, it was required of every student in the community college to take American Politics 101. I'm not sure many universities still do that. I won't go into any further detail on ones I know that don't, but I wonder if you could, as from the standpoint of a Yale political science professor, address this issue of whether or not universities need to step it up a little bit.
I'm with you on all this, brother. I am with you. Except for the political scientist part. I'm a historian.
Right.
But the rest of it, I'm completely with. I do think it does have to be, I'm going to agree with you, but I do think it's important that we have civics in schools.
Sure.
In public school, mandatory early on, because there are some things which come easier when you're younger, like the three branches of government, which are, the idea that each branch is to balance the others. These things can be intuitive or not, depending on when you learn them. If you grow up without this, or if you grew up in a tyrannical system, or if you grow up as a wealthy person who you think law is never going to touch you, like Donald Trump, these things are not intuitive later on. They're really not. And so they do have to be taught early. But I agree with you 100% about universities. And so I'm not going to bug the political scientists, but it's true about them too. We, like at Yale, we don't really have a class, like a one semester class where you could say, here is a basic history or the basic setup of the American system. We don't have that. I mean, because the easiest things are in a way the hardest to teach. Or sorry, the other way around. The things which seem easy are often the hardest to teach. And so often universities just don't do it, let alone require it, right? So I'm with you. I think that there should be a sort of core in American universities mm-hmm. which would involve learning about American institutions. And you go to other countries, like my kids have gone to school in Austria, and boy, I mean, not that they retained it necessarily, but they really were brought through Austrian institutions and Austrian history at a pretty young age.
And I think Richard Haass, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, has written an entire book on this subject. So any of our listeners that want to really get into it, that's the place to go. Thank you so much for joining us today, Timothy Snyder. This has been a great conversation, and that's because it's a great book and because it's a guy who really knows what he's talking about on freedom. Timothy Snyder, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It's been my pleasure, Bob. Thank you so much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.